Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Tuesday, July 14th, 2020. Producing from his home studio in the foothills of Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney. I'm working from my home studio in New York. And Taylor, yesterday, you know, after days and days and days of hearing a lot of uncertainty about whether or not this season will start, yesterday I really felt like the winds had changed a little bit. People that I talked to were talking about, you know what, I think we're going to get there. I think we actually are going to get started up next week. And they feel like that, you know, the players are getting into a rhythm of it. And I heard a lot of compliments about how the players and the staffers are following the health and safety protocol.
That is super encouraging. I feel like I've been a little more optimistic. I feel like when we had Ravi on last week and he was like, we'll probably start. Who knows about finishing? I felt good. But, you know, you're obviously, that's just me, you know, my intuition, my insights telling me it's go time. I'm glad to get some concrete info from you that it's looking good. You booked your hotel yesterday. We're marching on 9 days away from opening day.
Unbelievable. Yeah. 8 days away till I drive down to Washington, D.C., potentially. Ooh. To be reporting on the sidelines for the Nationals hosting the New York Yankees in the opener. Looks like Garrett Cole against Max Scherzer. Yesterday, Shohei Ohtani had his second summer camp outing. The first one had been very ugly. He had command issues. He was better yesterday. And afterward, Ohtani, through a translator, Angels manager Joe Maddon, talked about his most recent outing.
I think it was.
So I felt obviously much better than last time, performance-wise and command-wise. Yeah, my body feels really good overall. I was able to hit two straight days because my body felt well, and I was able to pitch well today. I felt really good physically after hitting in two straight games. I had no problems pitching. So I was saying physically I'm feeling good.
It was a little bit better than the last time, a little bit better command. Obviously, there's another level for him. But I thought it was a step forward. I don't know how he said he felt afterwards, but I thought overall it was a better performance. I still think once we get a real game going on with or without fans, you're going to see another level of him. This guy's all that good. But I thought he was better than the last time overall.
Yesterday was Cody Bellinger's 25th birthday, and his manager talked about changes that Bellinger has made to his hitting mechanics since we had the shutdown in mid-March.
You know, Cody, over quarantine, you know, was in Arizona working and thinking through some things. And there is certainly a swing change that, you know, you look at, you put eyes on it, and you see it's different than it was last year. So I think that for Cody, for us, it's just more of getting at-bats. Syncing up the new mechanics a little bit takes time. You know, he had a great, he won the MVP, but I think that for him, his words, he didn't have a good second half. And you know, as he finished the season, didn't feel comfortable and felt that, you know, he was open to a change, came up with the change, feels really comfortable where he's at mechanically. We haven't seen the results yet, and not that the results matter right now, but, you know, I think that it's an individual, it's a feel thing. And for me, as long as, you know, he has confidence in it, he's, you know, conferring and talking through things with hitting guys, you know, I'm optimistic.
As baseball ramped up, we heard that Charlie Blackmon, the all-star outfielder for the Colorado Rockies, had tested positive for coronavirus. Well, he's back on the field, and he spoke with the reporters yesterday.
I feel great. I have felt that way for at least a couple of weeks now. I had a day and a half of symptoms, and then after that, I started feeling much better. I want to be ready for opening day. That's a pretty short period of time to get ready for Major League Baseball. So I'll do my best, and that's kind of a goal.
The Athletic reports that Major League Baseball and the Players Association have reached an agreement as how to deal with contract options and bonuses in this shortened 2020 season. We've seen some real baseball injuries. Byron Buxton of the Twins hurt his left foot tracking a fly ball on Monday and was carted off, but it looks like he could be okay. Manager Rocco Baldelli said the team is cautiously optimistic. His quote, Fortunately, relatively speaking, the initial once-over didn't show anything, which I take as a cautiously optimistic good sign. Baltimore Orioles left-hander Ty Block will undergo season-ending Tommy John surgery. Shortstop Richie Martin will have an operation on his right wrist that will sideline him for 2 to 3 months. Robinson Chirinos, the veteran catcher playing with the Texas Rangers, had rolled an ankle when a teammate slid into him at home plate on Monday. The initial images that were taken on X-ray came back negative, but manager Chris Woodward acknowledged that it's concerning to say the least when you have a catcher rolling his ankle. So we'll get more information about that probably later today. The Detroit Tigers cut ties with Zach Godley, giving the right-hander his release. Ron Gardenhire, the Detroit manager, said the move was made to give Godley a chance to catch on with another team. Hard-throwing Cardinals reliever Jordan Hicks has opted out of the season. We're going to be talking about that with Derek Gould of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch coming up. Cubs manager David Ross and five other Tier 1 individuals did not attend the team's workout on Monday because they had not gotten test results back. And this was done out of a feeling of caution that they didn't want to potentially expose players to staffers who may have been positive for coronavirus. And Robinson Cano's situation continues to be murky. He's not working out with the Mets. He's not with a team, and it's unclear whether he'll be available or potentially will opt out. Before we get to Sarah Langs to talk about that and to Manny Bell of MLB.com to discuss the Cleveland baseball franchise, a heads up, season 8 of the ESPN's latest 30 for 30 podcast is here. Heavy Metals Inside the Caroli Gymnastics Empire, a groundbreaking 7-part podcast series that takes listeners on a deep dive into the lives and influence of Bela and Marta Caroli, the most successful and controversial coaches in USA Gymnastics history. Subscribe now to the 30 for 30 feed to listen to the entire season on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
Numbers Game.
Sarah Langs is a reporter and a producer for MLB.com. And Sarah, I was just mentioning about how Robinson Cano has not been on the field yet for the Mets. And there's a lot of questions about, if he's going to participate, when he's going to participate. At the very least, it doesn't look like he'll be available at the start of games. You know the Mets well. It's established on this podcast that you have been a crazy Mets fan throughout your lifetime. What do you think the Mets' best plan B options are if he's a no-go?
Yeah. So, I mean, first of all, you know, with everything going on in the world, I really hope everything is okay. But aside from that, I mean, I think that when we found out about the National League having a DH or when those rumors began, I remember mentioning that if Cespedes weren't able to go, which now it looks like that he will be, that Cano could potentially be a good option even there. So I think that that's almost a way that I've started to reimagine that infield and outfield for them without him playing a position in there even before all this. But I think the most obvious thing, without really introducing any names from the minors or anyone that the Mets are a little or the fans might be unfamiliar with, would probably just be moving Jeff McNeil to second base from third, putting J.D. Davis at third base, and then having Dom Smith playing left field regularly, assuming that Yoenis Cespedes is going to be DHing and couldn't play the field. And, you know, I mean, from the McNeil side, I don't think there's really any downside. He was actually, he had the same number of outs above average at both second base and third base last year. And he actually played more second than anything else in 2018 when he first came up. So I don't think that that would be much of an issue. J.D. Davis has played third. I mean, that's what he initially played when he first came up with the Astros. He played there last year. He was actually worse in left field that last year than he was at third base. That may be partially a sample size issue, but I mean, he was -7 outs above average in left field and +1 at third base. So you would have to hope that with more exposure at third base, that wouldn't go down too much. Dom Smith in the outfield is a different situation. We saw that he's not necessarily the best defensively out there. Obviously, his best defensive position last year was at first base, but that's just not going to be much of an option with Pete Alonso, reigning Rookie of the Year winner, everything else going on there. So I think that that's honestly not the worst solution, and that's probably what I would imagine they would do. I think that, you know, Davis playing third, I'm pretty sure he's talked about wanting to his defense there. So, you know, you definitely want to sort of, you know, latch on to that and hope that he really takes that into consideration.
The Mets, of course, playing in the National League East, which is absolutely stacked, with the Braves having won the division the last 2 years, the Washington Nationals having won the World Series, the Phillies are in there. I just want to focus on the Nationals for a second. We've always heard that the greatest challenge for any team trying to repeat as champion is the hangover effect on pitching from year to year. In other words, a staff pitches deep into October, and the next year they're a little bit gassed. This situation is obviously going to be different. So do you feel like the 60-game season, and assuming that they're able to play it, helps the Nationals' chances of being the first team in about two decades to go back-to-back, or you think it hurts it?
I think it helps. I mean, as you said, we're used to that sort of hangover effect. We're used to pitchers being so tired after pitching basically into November and then having to come back and ramp back up in spring training. And they did that, but then they got some time off and, you know, trusting that guys are back to where they want to be. Obviously, I think Max Scherzer looked good yesterday, and I think it was something like four innings, and these guys are getting back to where they're supposed to be. You have to imagine that the chance for baseball-related injuries like that in terms of just too much workload has gone down. I think that it really helps them in that respect. I think with their pitching, my biggest question is the same question I had entering the year last year, and it ended up working out for them, and it's the bullpen. But we know that bullpen was not great. In the regular season, it was a over 5.5 ERA, and even the postseason, it was 4.44. And remember, in postseason, they had to use Corbin, Scherzer, and Strasburg out of the bullpen, which was 100% the right move. But when you're going to that in those kinds of situations, that does show a little bit about how you're feeling about that bullpen. So I think that that's the biggest question, but I don't think that that's related to the 60-game season, though I do think they will probably rely on the bullpen even more. I'm anticipating all of these teams to do that. So if that is a weak spot, it could be magnified. But I don't think that the World Series hangover type of effect is really going to apply here, because the season's starting July 23rd.
I kind of wonder, my biggest question is about corner infield offense with Anthony Rendon, off, having signed with the Angels in free agency in the wintertime. Ryan Zimmerman's out, and they, you know, are going to have a lot of new faces at the corners this year, and you wonder how they're going to make up for that lost offense. I get this question, I'm sure you see it a lot on social media, about how we're going to regard a champion for 2020. I don't really have that much of a difficult time with it. I just kind of feel like we're going to look at it, if they're able to complete it, in the same way that we look at the 1981 Dodgers. And I was a fan of that team where, you know, in the end, because they had a strike that took out about a third of the season, the numbers were all kind of jumbled. They didn't look the same. Some teams played 108 games. Some teams played 112 games. And I don't look at the Dodgers as being a comparable title in 81 to 88 because the season wasn't as long. How about you?
Yeah, I mean, that's very similar to the comparison I was going to make. You know, from the stats perspective, there are a lot of stats where we say, you know, excluding strike-shortened seasons. And usually that's because of, you know, very aberrant numbers, whether they're extremely low compared to something else, like the most home runs by a World Series champion, something like that. And I think that this season is going to fall in there. I think that we're just going to have to, when we talk about the fewest wins in a season to win the World Series, we're not going to mention this season because it's different. You know, we're going to say fewest wins in at least 154 game season, or however we're going to word that in the future. So I do think in that way, it's going to end up excluded from a lot of lists, which is sort of how I view it. You know, where is it going to fall when I look up stats in 10 years? But ultimately, I mean, I'll certainly still say, you know, you did win the World Series. That's certainly an accomplishment. And with everything going on in the world, maybe in its own way, it's almost more of an accomplishment, though for intangible and different reasons. But I do think that it's going to be hard to compare that to even, you know, the Nationals from this past year or any of those other teams.
Yeah, I mean, the Nationals could be a classic example of that, you know, no team has won a World Series in more than back-to-back World Series in more than two decades, as I mentioned. The 1998 to 2000 Yankees won three in a row. And if the Nationals win the World Series this year, then they will be regarded as the first team to have won back-to-back World Series since that team. And if some people say, yeah, but it wasn't the same, my response would be, you're right.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can't argue that, right? It's inarguable.
Yeah. It's, you know, first team to win back-to-back World Series in two full seasons versus not, you know, something like that. I think that that's definitely a point to be made. And the conversation that we just had, I mean, in certain ways, and some people like us might think that it is a little easier to repeat this year just because of when the season is starting, the structure of the schedule and everything else. And so if that's the case, then yeah, for your first like real repeat champions, or we don't even have to use the word real, but whatever it might be, full season, we probably would have to wait a bit for that.
And last one for you. I wrote on Sunday a little bit about this. I think I'm going to write more about it this upcoming Sunday, about how people in baseball right now are struggling with the concept of value. You know, we always hear about value where, you know, what's the value of a player going into free agency? You know, what's the value of a player who's up for trade, like a Francisco Lindor? And you know, it's through the use of analytics, I think teams probably have gotten really good at evaluating that. And that whole, the whole projection of that has completely changed and will change going forward, because the financial landscape in baseball, and as well as in industry across the world, is completely changing. You know, and we don't know where that's going to be. And I kind of, the more that I thought about it, I feel like that we really need an extended period of free agency, you know, perhaps this December into January, before we begin to restore that idea of value and where the parameters are. And I thought it's actually, to me, very comparable to 1976 when baseball free agency began. You know, there had been a couple of guys who had been free agents, Andy Messersmith, Catfish Hunter, but we didn't get the full range, a full class of free agents until the fall of 76. And so when guys like Reggie Jackson and Bobby Gritch and Raleigh Fingers went and hit the market, you didn't really know what was possible. And then all of a sudden, Reggie Jackson, you know, sets a bar, 5 years, $3.5 million. Wayne Garland got a 10-year contract, as you know. And then people began to get a sense of, okay, what are players really worth? And I kind of wonder if that's what we're going to need, Sarah, as baseball, as I mentioned, as well as the rest of the country, rebuilds into a new norm.
Yeah. I mean, I think the first thing that I thought of when reading that from you and hearing that is just like, what would Gerrit Cole be worth this offseason? I think it's a very different contract, as you said, for a number of different reasons. And I do think that this offseason can really define that. You know, we don't have a Gerrit Cole on the market in terms of pitching, but we do have Mookie Betts, and he may not get the type of deal that, you know, we perceive that he turned down the Red Sox extension for and all of that. But I think that that will set a sort of bar. And I think of the offseason entering the 2017 season, when Mark Melancon and then Kenley Jansen and then Aroldis Chapman each successively broke the record for the largest total value on a contract for a reliever, and how each of those broke not just the one that had been signed 2 weeks ago, but also all the previous ones. And I think it's almost like we need that to happen, but at every position or at a lot of different positions, just to show us what to expect, you know, because so much of this is the conversation, the way that things are surrounded. We've talked about $400 million for Mike Trout for so long, and then he got that extension entering last year. And, you know, what numbers should we be talking about? How many years should we be talking about? And we sort of need that to be set in order for us to know what to be expecting.
Yeah, a great example of that, J.D. Realmuto of the Phillies, mm-hmm. you know, told reporters last week that he had started conversations with the Phillies about a long-term deal, and then the pandemic hit, baseball was shut down, and now they're not really conversations. And you can sort of understand why from both sides. Like, yeah. If I'm the Phillies right now, you know, normally we would have looked at JT as being, okay, this is what Buster Posey got for catcher last winter. This is where Yasmani Grandal, where he fell. And this might be where JT falls in, something in the north of $100 million. But now we don't really know. And if I wouldn't blame the Phillies if I were to say, look, we want to see where the numbers go before we, you know, give him a contract, because we don't want to feel like we overpaid by 20 or 30%. And if you're JT, you don't want to settle low until you're on an open market and there's bidding. And then teams at that point are going to reveal themselves as to what's possible with their shifting budgets.
Yeah, you just need everyone to sort of reset, and you need to know what those numbers are. I agree. When I saw that that conversation had happened and then stopped based on what he said, that made all the sense in the world to me, because it's almost like you're negotiating two different contracts. You know, I think that the first idea of the contract extension in February, or whenever those conversations were taking place, is just completely different from what would happen if they were to have that conversation today, or if they were to have it in the offseason with him on the open market in December. So I'm interested to see. And I mean, as you referred to with him, you know, there's Mookie Betts, there's definitely some intriguing names on the market this offseason. Marcus Semien was, you know, an MVP candidate last year. He's another one. George Springer. So I think that there are enough, you know, good players out there this offseason to help us do that and to show what it's going to be. But it's going to be really interesting.
Last one before we go, real quick. Where do you think Mookie Betts lands this offseason? Because I turned this in for ESPN.com, and I think you're going to like the answer.
Really? That's interesting to hear that you set it up that way. My goodness, are you saying I have to, I mean, there's two teams we talk about with me, so now I'm just wondering about that. But I mean, I could certainly see the Mets trying to make a play, if that's what you're saying. I think that he's certainly indicated that maybe something like a New York type of money, if the Mets are willing to go there, could be really interesting. But I really don't know.
Yeah, I think he's, if in fact, whether it's Steve Cohen or some other group buys the Mets, you know they're going to want to go in and make a splash right away and announce their presence with authority and guess who's going to be the best player on the market. And I also think we sort of learned about Mookie and the way that he's looking at his negotiations, unless he just likes the Dodgers so much and L.A. and his early feel that he's like, you know what, I just want to make a deal. But if that's not the case, if he feels like, look, because I'm the number one free agent, I have to take the most money possible to set the market for everybody else, I could see him being with the Mets next year, and that'd be very interesting.
Can you imagine Betts and Judge in New York? I mean, there's so much to be done there. That could be those interleague games. A lot of fun. That could be really interesting.
Exactly. All right, Sarah, thank you.
Thanks so much, Buster.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code BASEBALL. That's code BASEBALL. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes, the clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, 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 with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
Derek Gould covers the St. Louis Cardinals for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And Derek, yesterday we got news about Jordan Hicks, that he's opting out of the season because he's a big name, because he's the hardest thrower in baseball. It got a lot of attention, but it felt like it was sort of inevitable. Tell me about the thinking behind what happened.
Yeah, you know what? I agree with that kind of description there. This was a long conversation, one that really began back in spring training, to be candid, as he was getting ready for the more intensive elements of his throwing program. He had Tommy John surgery last year after, you know, about 14 saves right there around the midseason. And he was expected to be back this year, all things being equal, a little bit after the All-Star break. But, you know, he's type 1 diabetes. He actually has diabetic phenom stitched onto his glove. And he's been very candid about that. The Cardinals even built in, and he working with him, an extra month in his rehab process because they weren't quite sure how his diabetes would impact his rehab, his recovery, his healing process. He didn't have any setbacks. He didn't have anything along the way, but they just wanted to at least create that possibility that if he needed a break or had trouble coming, getting strength back, that it would be possible for him to do so. You know, he comes to camp. He was part of the 60-man roster that they put out there, but the conversation continued. He threw a bullpen at Busch Stadium on one of the first days of this quote unquote summer camp, but the conversation continued. And eventually here a week or so in, you know, he's continued his throwing program, but the Cardinals and him have decided that, you know, the pre-existing condition, the fact that, you know, he would be healthy for maybe the final, say, 6 weeks of this season, 7 weeks of the season, that there wasn't a reason to put undue risk on him and that he would opt out. He, because of the type 1 diabetes, he obviously qualifies for full salary and for the service time. And they just felt that it was the right healthy decision for him. It does leave the bullpen another person down, which really has been the story of summer camp for the Cardinals, is that their bullpen just hasn't been fully together. And there's really no indication that it will be. John Brebbia is gone because of Tommy John. Giovanni Gallegos has had travel difficulties getting from Mexico. Yenesis Cabrera has, you know, announced that he tested positive for COVID-19, had a second positive test since then. So they're really looking for relievers, and they're really going to test their depth there.
Yeah, I was going to ask you later in an interview about their biggest challenge on the field as they come back. And it certainly sounds like that in your eyes, that might be it.
I think they have the depth to overcome it, to be honest. And like young guys like Cody Whitley and Johan Oviedo are ready to step in. The biggest challenge for this Cardinals team is the one that they still had leaving last season. It's how are they going to score runs? You know, from this team, they let their cleanup hitter walk, and they feel like they can get that same production from left field or from cleanup, even more production from cleanup, you know, that 800, 850 OPS from either one person or from a committee of people. But that's no guarantee. And if that's no guarantee, then an improvement on last year's offense also isn't a guarantee. And this is a team that was the lowest scoring team of any playoff teams, last year. It put such an emphasis on their pitching, relied so heavily on their bullpen to hold games. And well, they have the talent out there. The question really is, will they have the runs to at least give them a breather every so often?
So during the shutdown, I'm you went through the labor talks. I got asked the question a lot. I'm sure you did too, as it was a stalemate that was developing. Okay, who are the leaders on each side that are needed? You know, people who could emerge. And I thought, although there was no baseball going on, that one of the interesting things that happened was the emergence of Jack Flaherty as a leader in baseball. And that really, you know, initially was about the labor talks when he was tweeting out about that. A lot of social media response to the labor talks. And then after the killing of George Floyd, you know, he continued to emerge even further. And I feel like in 5 years, you know, guys like Walker Buehler will be really important. Jack Flaherty, to me, sort of cemented with what he's done the last 3 months that in the years to come, he's going to be one of the big leaders in baseball. You've known him since he broke into the big leagues. Tell me about what you saw in the emergence of a young man.
Oh, yeah. I've known him since the day he was drafted, and they put him on a phone call with us, to be honest. And we watched his kind of ascent there from high A and got to know him and more about his family and his mom there. The phrase is like a guy finds his voice, right? I think he knew what his voice was because we've had a chance to talk with him, and he's been very forward, very candid, also very pointed in his comments about being renewed each of the past 2 years. He made a stance. He said, look, I'm rejecting what the Cardinals are saying my salary is, and I'll take the $10,000 penalty that is the Cardinals policy. On principle, I don't want to be told that this is what I'm worth because I'm not. And I don't want to go into arbitration and have somebody say that I accepted that salary because I'm not. I did not accept that salary. And he has always been really forthright with that. What we've seen now is just basically an amplification of that voice. He used social media to drop sarcastic gifts there. The little videos on Twitter that he would put out there just as like a little riff, a little satire on the ongoing negotiations between the players and the owners, and his eye rolls, some literal, some metaphorical, about, you know, the responses from the owners. And then you're right. Because of the social unrest and the racial injustice, he pivoted. The Twitter feed that for him, used to be a lot of shouting out how much of a fan of Kobe Bryant he was, or sharing Kobe Bryant highlights, or talking about Kobe Bryant's death, gained this, like, kind of swelled to a larger volume as he started talking about the labor relations and labor discussions in baseball, and then, of course, into the social factors and how to draw more attention to some of the injustices going on. I think we saw a young man get traction in what he always wanted to be. He started to be. And you're right. I mean, I think in a lot of ways, he has the potential to be the face of baseball. He's talked very openly, Buster, about wanting to be more active when it comes to youth baseball, particularly when it comes to getting African-American boys involved in baseball. He wants to be more present there, more of someone who can rally the game at a younger level and inspire the game at a younger level. I think we're also going to see him used as Exhibit A when it comes to the new CBA for how younger players should be paid more when they're producing better. And his career will be trotted out as an example of how that works, or how that could work, and why it's important for the young players that it does work.
What's the bedrock in his background that is behind this in terms of how, you know, he was raised, his awareness? And obviously, I mean, I've talked to him in just a fraction of what you've talked to him. Man, is he a smart kid?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think, you know, a year ago on Mother's Day, I did a story. I think the headline was Five Tool Single Moms, or the Five Tool Moms. And it had its genesis in spring training, where I was talking with a lot of the players. And, you know, I've known Adam Wainwright and covered Adam Wainwright for the entirety of his major league career. And long ago, I did a story about his mom and older brother, his single mom and older brother, helping him and raising him and working with him. And it dawned on me that, you know, there were a handful of Cardinal pitchers, all of whom who had gotten pretty close, would talk quite a bit, who had single mothers. And, you know, Jack is one of them. He's the adopted son of a single mother. He has a brother as well. And, you know, recently on a podcast that he was the guest on with former Cardinal Matt Holliday, he was telling the story, and I thought it was really revealing. And it's one that he's kind of touched on before, and did so in the story I did for Mother's Day, where he's like, people come up to him and ask him things like, you know, like reporters do, like, hey, where do you get your competitiveness? Where do you get your drive? Where do you get your athleticism? Where do you get your work ethic? And he was saying that, you know, a lot of times he lapses into the answers that are kind of, you know, the usual, right? Like, you know, the phonograph spins and they say the same thing. And he said, you know, I often say, like, well, somebody goes, where do you get work ethic? He goes, well, I don't know any different. He goes, the realization is I don't know any different because I saw my mom work. Hmm. I saw that she was working before I got up. I saw that I couldn't get up quicker and get to work than she did. I saw what she did with two boys, raising them on her own. He goes, that's where I got my work ethic. It's, I don't know any different because that's the example she set for me. And I think in talking to him and knowing him and talking with her and getting to know her, I think you see such a strong presence from the mom and such a eagerness from the son to live up to that presence that it's hard to miss.
That's awesome. All right, Derek, thanks for doing this, and good to talk with you again.
Yeah, good to talk with you too. It's great to hear you, and you know, it'll be good that we can talk a little baseball, and hopefully everybody is healthy enough and aware enough and conscientious enough that this baseball season gets off the ground.
For the ones who get it done, Grainger offers high-quality supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as access to product specialists who have the knowledge and experience to answer your toughest questions. Plus, their commitment to being your safety partner can help you keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of the show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Buster. Just go to Indeed.com/Buster right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Buster. Terms and conditions apply.
Manny Bell covers the Cleveland baseball franchise for MLB.com. And Manny, as you know, we're all sort of struggling with how we should refer to the baseball franchise from Cleveland because they have indicated that the name Indians is under review. Where do we stand with that right now?
I mean, the team hasn't really given us too much of an update aside from what they said about 2 weeks ago that wanted to determine the best path forward. I think right now they're going through the process of having every conversation that they can have. And I know that's something that was important to them to make sure they're talking with the right people to understand what their name means to everybody. And if it is offensive to groups out there, then they want to make sure that they're figuring out what they can do to make sure that it is not offensive to anyone. And I think from talking to Tito and all the players so far, everyone sort of had the same mindset whenever they're discussing all of this, and they're saying we just want to do what's best, and if there's any time in the world to listen, right now is the time to do that. And so that's all they want to do at this point. Timing wise, I don't know how long it'll take, but it looks like it'll get there eventually.
Do you think that the decision made by the football franchise formerly known as the Redskins puts pressure on Cleveland to make a change and or at least formally indicate that they're going to change?
Yeah, I'm sure it does at least a little bit. I don't know just because the season is starting so soon. I don't know how quickly they could get this turned around. I mean, with the branding and just having to fix and change everything that you have, and just their focus is obviously majority on the season right now. So I think the timing's a little bit weird for them, but it definitely will expedite the process. I think just having the Washington franchise moving so quickly.
Among the many names, potential names of the Indians that have been mentioned interest you the most?
I think the Cleveland Spiders is one that has interested most people. I know Anthony Kastrovitz with us, he did a great piece on the Cleveland Spiders possibly being their name. And I know there's a lot of people who are really hoping for that historically. Now, the Spiders weren't necessarily a part of their franchise because it was before 1900, before they were in the American League. But they were the Cleveland baseball team here from like 1889 to 1899. So there's so much history there. The team's record wasn't that great. So there's some confusion there with some people about why they would take on a team that wasn't that great. But I think that one's out there. I've heard the Cleveland Guardians. I've heard people asking for the Cleveland Rocks or Cleveland Rockers. I think the Hall of Fame theme maybe, yeah, a little overdone, but I mean, that's out there too. So there's definitely some options, but I'm intrigued by the Cleveland Spiders.
All right. Last week, the Indians had a situation that popped up that I think got everybody's attention around baseball because of all the teams, you know, in baseball, the Indians are certainly among the clubs that are considered to have some of the best leadership. Chris Antonetti at the head of baseball ops. He's one of the best in the game, if not the best. You have Terry Francona's manager, future Hall of Famer. Francisco Lindor, leader in the clubhouse, respected. And then, of course, Carlos Carrasco last year. You know, going through treatment for leukemia, he's the embodiment of what potentially could be high risk. And yet the Indians had a situation that scared everybody a little bit. Can you just sort of walk us through that and what your perspective was, you know, from talking to people within the organization?
Yeah, absolutely. Framil Reyes went to a 4th of July event without a mask. There was a bigger group of people. They were not social distancing. He posted some videos. I think it was to his Instagram page, and people within the organization saw that and reached out to him immediately and informed him not to show up to practice. They wanted to make sure that they were going to take the necessary precautions, that if somehow he would have been exposed to the virus there, he was not going to bring it in to the facility with him. They asked him to get tested immediately, and he was not able to come back until those tests came back negative, to be absolutely sure. It was a learning experience. And when we talked to Terry Francona about it, he just kept saying over and over again, he is not in the doghouse. We want to make sure this is clear. We understand that this is a unique situation and everyone's trying to figure out and adjust to the guidelines that we have. It was a mistake, and this is what we're using as a learning experience. And Tito said that he went around and started talking to guys about it. I know they can't have bigger group discussions right now, so he's been having smaller discussions with people on the sides, and he's just been saying, look, this is going to be what we have to do this year. This is what this season's going to be like, and we need everybody to be 100% committed to this if we want to try to make sure the season gets played in its entirety, and we want to be the team that's trying to stay as responsible as possible. And that when we talked to some of his teammates, they all said the same thing. And we're like, this was something that we all can learn from, that we saw this, and that there's not going to be any slip ups this year without some sort of a penalty for it, because we just want to make sure that everyone's staying safe. It's bigger than the game even. And we just, health comes first. And so that's how they've looked at it. And whenever Framel came back, he couldn't have been more apologetic. And he just said that he grew from it as well. And he wants to make sure that everyone around him saw what he had to go through and make sure they were learning along with him.
Mandy, it felt, as it played out, it felt like from afar, like, you know what, this is almost a good thing that this happened. Like it was, they're almost lucky that this happened early in the process in this way.
Absolutely. I mean, having this be like 3 or 4 days into camp, that was just, get that out of the way, have everyone see that they are super serious about this, as they should be. And I think everyone can understand going forward now that we're in the regular season, that I think that just the importance of staying safe will only continue as this goes on.
All right. On the field, from your perspective, what are the most important factors in determining how good this team can be?
Well, one that will be the health of the rotation. As long as their rotation stays healthy, I think that they have a good chance. I mean, Tito says it going into every season. As long as you have pitching, you're in it every single year, no matter what else you have. And they have Shane Bieber, Mike Clevenger, Carlos Carrasco as their top three. Aaron Civale, Zach Plesac, and Adam Pletko right now are sort of fighting it out for those last two spots. Savali seems like he's a lead in the race. He might be fighting in at number four, and so that leaves Plesac and Pletko as fighting it out for five. But no matter what, the depth they have rotation-wise, I think it'll always keep them in it, especially when you have a 1-2 punch like Bieber and Clevenger. And then I think just going from there, it'll be a lot of it is going to fall on Franmil Reyes, I think. I mean, he's just going to be a difference maker in that lineup. And whenever you compare from last year where they were at the start of the season to this year, that batting order just has so much more depth. And I think the power that he can bring in the middle of the order is something that could 100%, like I said, be a difference maker. He was on fire during spring training. After the last 3.5 months, he said he never even saw a live pitcher during the break for quarantining. So whenever he came back to Progressive Field, that was his first time seeing a live pitcher again, and so his timing was really off whenever he first started, but it now seems like he's starting to settle in a little bit more. Took a double off the top of the left field wall last night, so things are starting to click for him, and I think that's going to be a big factor for the Indians.
All right, Mandy, good to talk with you again.
Yeah, thanks so much, Buster.
Bleacher Tweets.
All right, Buster, Bleacher Tweets for Tuesday. Coming in with the starting block at the starting block, he writes in, with how everything has turned out, is Mike Trout's decision to extend with the Angels with a year to go instead of going to free agency now the smartest contract decision in Major League Baseball history in retrospect? What do you think?
I think it's more nuanced than that. I think there's some good fortune. I mean, who would have imagined there'd be a world pandemic in place that would shift the market in the way that we're going to see? And also on top of that, I think Mike, he's someone who doesn't necessarily like change. We know that because he goes home to Millville every offseason. He's built his home in Millville. His kids are going to go to high school in Millville. So that's sort of him. But you know what, Taylor? This is a reminder. A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. Like, and we've seen you know, players turn down huge contract offers and their feeling is, you know what, I could get a little bit more if I wait. But I think in this case, he got offered a ton of money. It would have been, you know, probably a mistake to turn it down. And man, it's paying off now.
Yeah, he could have bet on himself. I'm sure he would have made more, but it might have been marginal. I guess when we're talking about that sum of cash. Next up, PK Steinberg writes in from March.
PK,
our guy, from March to July, the players quote unquote had off. This is the same amount of time roughly as the offseason. Do you think Major League Baseball would consider shortening spring training if the players are in good shape to perform?
PK, the answer is no, for a couple reasons. One, you know, that's sort of the rhythm of the sport. And I think people like, you know, having that time now where players train physically. They begin throwing sometime, pitchers do in December now, typically. And by the time they get to spring training, they're ramped up and ready to go. But the number one factor about spring training, and I've had many executives acknowledge this to me off the record through the years, they play those last 3 weeks of spring training essentially for the affiliates, for the sites there where they know they're going to be drawing good spring training crowds, and they're paying bills playing those games.
That makes sense. Last one. Debbie Gammons Brown writes in, so Boog Shambi describes it as obscene, but if it were entirely up to you, Buster, would baseball be played before dawn? What is your ideal? What would be your ideal timing for a baseball game? Is that 8 a.m.
Yeah.
sharp?
Nah, you know, the more that I thought about this, I'm thinking that it would be, how cool would it be if we had games played from 4:30 a.m. and they finish up around 7:30, 8 o'clock. And Taylor, as you and I are getting ready for the podcast, we got all these results to react to. A lot of new information to respond to. That would be pretty cool.
It'd be amazing. I love morning games of any kind. I mean, when the Olympics are on and it's on the other side of the world, you got some early morning action. The MLS, we got a game on right now. DC United played yesterday. I love the early morning games. I'd like more of them. Unfortunately, not going to
happen. Oh, yeah. Yeah, when I've traveled, you know, and I've taken vacations and the NFL games are on at like 7 a.m., that is awesome.
Yeah. Jealous of the West Coasters, only for that reason.
Exactly.
All right, that does it for Bleacher Tweets. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. Thanks, everyone.
My thanks to Mandy, to Sarah, to Derek, and Taylor. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. And remember, every day we must fight against hate and inequality based on skin color.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.